This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 78. Please stop touching my captain. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including which series fans most want to see next on Blu-ray, whether or not the TNG cast should reunite in the Abramsverse, and an onslaught of movie news that's sure to detonate the show. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Matthew Rushing to discuss the Voyager episode 1159. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. It's great to see you back here on Earth today. I understand you've spent the entire weekend in Middle Earth.
Yes, I was far over the Misty Mountains, cold. Yes, but I have returned. I went there and back again. I don't know how many more jokes I can make. Yes, I would stop the rain, and yet I'm not Gandalf, and Gandalf can't do that anyway. Anyway, The Hobbit. I talked about it on the Observation Lounge, so I'm fine now. I'm good. I did see it three times over the weekend, but I'm good now.
Yeah, right. Three times. That's what you told me. I think you saw it in every format. I understand that tomorrow you're going to be doing a private screening on beta tape that's not actually going to be released to the public, but they just felt like you needed to see it in one more format.
I've seen the three major formats. I'm missing a couple of the more minor ones. We'll see how that goes. There's not a Dolby Atmos theater that I can get to easily. So I'm actually worried. I'm hoping they install one before next May, because I really want the Atmos experience for Into Darkness.
Now, was it as good as the Voyager episode in which they reenacted the Hobbit on the holodeck and the Doctor played the central role?
I really like that. Yeah, Kim goes and steals a bunch of gold, and then Chakotay has to go after him and then gets vaporized. And then the Doctor, yes, has to go on a quest with, oh goodness, I just watched that Heroes and Demons, Voyager. Yeah. It's not bad. It keeps changing what episode it is. It's first a holodeck malfunction, then it's a Doctor episode, and then it's Rite of Chaotica all of a sudden. Anyway.
I don't mind that episode so much myself, but I notice often when younger Star Trek fans are tweeting and they get to that episode, they often tweet like, I just had to read this in school and now you expect me to watch it on Voyager? Come on.
Well, I mean, between when that episode came out and now, Robert Zemeckis released a Beowulf film that's like good. I mean, it was computer generated, but still production quality. It was like amazing. And now we're seeing like the Masterpiece Theater version of it on the holodeck. Anyway, my Voyager rewatch is going well. I'm almost done with season one. But that was basically my weekend. My weekend was either watching The Hobbit or watching Voyager.
Well, I have embarked on my news radio rewatch.
Ooh, nice.
Which is, to be honest, probably about the 10th time I've rewatched news radio. But yes, I kind of needed a laugh recently, so I pulled out my DVDs. And I'm starting back in on season one.
Wow. So I guess my question would be, how much are you looking forward to the Blu-ray re-release of News Radio that I'm sure is coming quite soon?
I am definitely looking forward to it because, you know, one thing that maybe it's inspired by Star Trek, probably is that there are a number of occasions on News Radio where Matthew actually does a barrel roll in the studio.
Very nice. I do understand there was a StarTrek.com poll where they asked what series people want to see most on Blu-ray. And unfortunately, News Radio did not win. I don't even think it made it into the top three.
I know, it's weird. I have no idea how that's even possible. But no, News Radio did not make it in. But there were three series that did make it in. And one of them is not the animated series. So that leaves us with Enterprise, which is coming to Blu-ray in just a few months, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. And Greg, now, I know this is a tricky question, being a StarTrek.com poll, but which series do you think won this poll?
And the thing that kills me is the film, the show they want to see next on Blu-ray, and people still said Voyager. Not even most. It's not even like, which one are you most excited for? People want to see out of order. Like, let's do TOS, then TNG, then Voyager.
Yeah.
Why? I don't get it.
It feels like it's the late 1990s again, where everyone just forgot about Deep Space Nine because, hey, here's Voyager. And, oh, you mean there's another Star Trek series on? Oh, right. You mean it was on before Voyager started? Really? I thought that Voyager came after The Next Generation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what my family did. Like, we skipped DS9, but still.
Yeah, but your case is understandable because of your age and your parents correctly felt that Deep Space Nine was not the series for you guys to watch as a family. So that's, yeah, completely understandable. But yeah. I don't know. I just, it's interesting to me here that Voyager won the poll with 48%. DS9 got 42%, but StarTrek.com, as they always do, after the results, they listed comments from a number of voters. If you read the comments, they're mostly in favor of Deep Space Nine. And even the one that mentions Voyager says, Voyager was good in some point of view. It was not a classic Star Trek. I love all of them, TOS, TNG, DS9, Voyager, because every series reflected the audience, the new generation of fans. And every series has its own magic. So, I don't know, the poll results are kind of odd to me. I do want to see Voyager on Blu-ray, but
absolutely.
I'd like to see DS9 next.
Yeah, I really want to see DS9 next. I want to see the Dominion War on Blu-ray. I want to see, like, the details in the sets. I mean, the sets they built for Deep Space Nine are really cool, and the sets on Voyager are just more generic and flat-looking. There's not all these different levels of things and happening all around. There's just less visual interest on Voyager in general, and that's what makes me want to see. But, I mean, yes, if you talk about the later seasons of Voyager especially, they get into some really cool situations. There's some really great battles that happen, and it will be great to see on Blu-ray, especially if they do some sort of remastering where they make the shots brand new with an upgraded Voyager model. That'd be really cool to see, because there are some really awful shots. There's some that like look specifically like they're 30 frames per second. So they look very video gamey because it's early on CG. So yeah, go do that. I definitely want to rewatch Voyager on Blu-ray. But yeah, can we get DS9 first, please? That's all I want.
Yeah, that's the thing. I want them all on Blu-ray. And I was just thinking about earlier that despite the fact that I dished out all the money for every season of every series on DVD, I'm still going to end up getting all these things on Blu-ray once again. And then I'll probably get them on Red-ray or whatever it's going to be, you know, 4G, 8G, whatever next television technology is. But like you, I want to see the sets on DS9. I want to see the lighting. I want to see all those textures we've talked about on here before. And I just want them to do them in order. That's basically what I want. And I'm just, again, surprised about the poll results.
Yeah, there must be some Voyager fan subreddit that just gets a hold of these polls and sends everybody in. I mean, I don't think there's anyone gaming it, but I just think there's so many Voyager fans out there that mobilize.
Well, it's like on Trek FM, when we run polls and we have an Enterprise answer. There was a period of time in the past on Trek FM anyway, where Enterprise, the fans would just mobilize and they would all go and they would start hashtagging Team Enterprise, Team Archer, Team Hoshi, Team Porthos, you know, on Twitter. And they would just get everyone over and they would actually hold their own quite well in those polls. But one thing I wanted to ask you, Greg, is with DS9, especially when you get to the later seasons, some of those space battles are extremely complex.
Yeah.
Do you think that they will simply do them over from scratch? And do you want them to just do them over from scratch? Or do you want them to try to simply remaster what already exists?
What I want to see the most is for them to do them from scratch and try to perfectly match the original shots, at least as close as they can get. You know, if there's some motion that doesn't look right, they can fix it. What I don't want to see is like brand new shots that are from different angles like they did with the original series.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd be fine with them remastering. It's just later seasons, they're mixing computer effects and model shots. I just feel like it would be a pain for them to do all of that over again. And we're going to start seeing the seams in a lot of it. I feel like we're going to see the strain of it. Like we saw in season two, if they don't spend all of the money making these shots perfect, it starts looking a little less quality. So I don't want to see that from DS9 where we get just big blurs of action and matte lines. So I wouldn't have a problem with it if they redid the shots in CG, but I really don't want them to just make new shots from whole cloth. That's I want to see the show that we have just better.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think I would prefer for them to start over from scratch, but like you said, try to match what happened on the screen originally as closely as possible. Although I'm not so picky that if they get something just slightly off, you know, like the trajectory of the ship is just slightly off or something, I'm not going to write a blog post and rant about it. But
oh yeah,
but I agree that yeah, I don't want to see something that's just completely new thrown into the episode either.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the only thing I would like to see is during the middle of that big battle between the Dominion and the Klingons and the Federation, when the Andorian fight scene begins.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
I mean, that's a great element they can stick in there that'll up the tension. That's really the only thing I'd like to see them at.
I have to agree on that, absolutely. I really think that the Andorians are going to be a great asset to the Federation in fighting the Jem'Hadar. How they board those Jem'Hadar ships and actually do fight scenes with all of the Jem'Hadar.
I think it'll be great. I'm actually, that is one thing. I wouldn't mind seeing them add some non-Starfleet ships. Like, when did the Federation become like everyone has Earth ships? Like, I like that there's Vulcan ships out there. I'd like to see what the Andorians are making in the 24th century. What, you know, the Tellarites. Surely the Tellarites are still making starships.
It is interesting, right? That you know they're there. You know that all of these races have their own ships. They have their own organizations. They definitely have their own science vessels out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like when it comes to the military, that they are all assigned to Starfleet vessels at this point. We just never see anything else.
And that's a case of they just didn't have the money for all of these things, and hopefully the JJ films will show, they'll just have the ability to show more things, and hopefully we'll see more things like that, where we just see lots of different types of ships, lots of different types of worlds that we never got a chance to see the first time through, just because they're working from a TV budget, a TV mindset.
Right, except in the Abrams verse, instead of Andorian fight scenes, we have Andorian hug scenes.
Yes, definitely. Now, we actually did have something JJ-related that's not movie-related per se. We have Jonathan Frakes, who apparently said that he's hopeful that the TNG cast will be able to reunite in the JJ verse.
Yeah, this was interesting to me because all the talk has been about which original series character would you like to see reprise their role in the Abrams verse. I haven't heard a lot of talk about Next Generation characters. And I mean, I suppose you could find a way to make it work, but is it even something that you, Greg, as a Star Trek fan, are interested in seeing?
Well, I'm really hoping that Into Darkness at the end, it's revealed that the whole film was just a holo novel that William Riker was doing during the episode The Pegasus. He just wanted to be reminded of how Kirk handled that whole detonating the Starfleet situation.
Yeah.
I really love when
and
they do that.
Everything it stands for.
Well, yes. Yes. I can't imagine a TNG actor being in the TNG verse. That we did get Star Trek Countdown, the comic that led into Space Adventure 2009, that did have actors. It had New Data, the B4. It had Geordi and Picard, and I think Riker was in it, although Riker may have been off. It showed them sort of building the squid ship and all of that. But there was no reason for anyone from that universe to come into the JJ verse. Like, I feel like we had the incursion, and that needs mm-hmm. to be the last incursion.
I think so too.
Anything yeah. else they did, even in the comics, I just think would be overdone.
Yeah, I don't want to see any more original series characters in the Abrams verse, and I certainly don't want to see any TNG characters, because it just doesn't make sense to me. I just let it be its own thing, and don't try to force some. I guess it feels like it would be one of these holiday special reunion show kind of atmospheres that we would have going if we tried to find a way to get prime universe TNG characters into the Abramsverse movies.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way I would think of it. In a comic, maybe you can have a little bit of fun bringing somebody in for an episode. Like, there's a transporter malfunction, and oh, hey, look, it's Geordi. And then Geordi helps them solve some problem and then goes back. I just definitely not in the films. Let's not do any of that in the films.
Yeah, maybe in the comics, they could do something, have their own little comic shoot off series.
Sure.
The Next Generation ongoing. I don't know.
Honestly, once the JJ films are done, like if JJ does a trilogy and then he's done and they move on to the next thing, it would be cool to see the JJ version of TNG as a comic.
Yeah,
like
as a comic.
The Next Generation ongoing.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know how it would be different. I don't know what they do. And you'd get riots in the streets from fans for changing things. But I could see them like going back and doing first season episodes like the way the Star Trek ongoing did. But as far as anything like a crossover.
Minor differences at first, you know, like in The Naked Now, Data would reveal that he's actually impotent. It would just be very small little things. And then as you go on, the changes would become larger and larger as they did in the Star Trek ongoing comic.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what they would do with that. Let's leave anything with TNG cast. Let's just leave them for now. How about we just don't talk about TNG coming back for like 10 years, and then we'll revisit it.
Okay, we'll revisit then. Okay, so Greg, we have just a huge bag full of movie news today, Star Trek Into Darkness news. And so before we jump into that, let's just take a quick moment here to thank our sponsor, Squarespace. Greg, I have been doing quite a bit of work recently in the new Squarespace 6, and I've been working on building a full-on website, and I have been very impressed with all the new features that are in this latest release.
So what are you finding? I mean, I'm hearing there's a lot of changes that they've made. What are you finding that's specifically making your life easier using 6 instead of 5?
Well, one thing is the new drag and drop interface. A lot of websites that I use for project management, not really for website building, but for project management, they've started to move towards this drag and drop interface where you can drag images over, and instead of having to go through dialog boxes, you know, and find the files, and it's just so much easier when you can drag them right over. And this is a central part of Squarespace 6. And between putting images onto your pages, putting them in your articles, putting them in your headers, creating thumbnails, because Squarespace 6 can generate automatic index pages, and not just pages, but even components within other pages for you. And being able to drag and drop images that way has made my life so much easier.
Nice. That's really cool. But now, what if you want to dig into the code and make like really specific changes? Is that still something you can do?
Definitely is. And actually, you can do it even more so than you could in the past with Squarespace. Of course, you can edit CSS and do all your custom CSS if you're a coder and you like to do that. Squarespace has very easy sliders that you can use to change the styles and the typography and the colors and everything. But you can also write your own custom CSS. And if you're a developer and you want absolute full control and you basically want a blank canvas and you want to build your entire website completely from scratch, you can actually go into developer mode on Squarespace 6 and you get normal FTP access, you get your file structures, you get everything is completely customizable, kind of the way you would work in Dreamweaver traditionally with just a file server. But you can do it on Squarespace, and then you can leverage all the power of Squarespace at the same time.
Okay, so what sort of websites can I actually create with Squarespace? I'm assuming I could make like my own blog. Like I want to just put up my daily thoughts about every time I go see The Hobbit again, what did I think of it? Well, this time, how was this different from the last six times? And that's most of the websites I see, you know, when I think of like a blogging platform. But Squarespace can do more than that, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, Squarespace is not just a blogging platform. A lot of people think of WordPress. Mm-hmm. And WordPress really is kind of a blogging platform. You know, you install WordPress and you set up a blog, basically, or a journal, and you post your articles there. But in Squarespace, you can have unlimited blogs or journals, that type of component in the site. And it can allow you to build just about any site that you can imagine. You know, think of your favorite websites, something like The Verge, for example, which I don't think is built on Squarespace, but this kind of very, very meaty, informative site with many, many sections and many sections that feel independent from one another. Like a news site, that's all very easy to do with Squarespace. And in fact, that's what I'm doing right now.
Very cool. So what exactly, I mean, you've sold me. You've sold me on Squarespace. I'm going to go experiment with it. What's the best way for me to jump into the Squarespace? And is there any sort of offer code that they're still doing with us?
There absolutely is. You can go to squarespace.com/trek and you can sign up there for a 14-day free trial. And the great thing about Squarespace is that there's no credit card request, nothing like this to get started. You just go in, you put in your username, put in your email, you get your free site set up, and you can use all the tools for 14 days. After that, if you decide to continue your site and purchase, you can use the code TREK12, TREK12, and you can get 10% off of the already very inexpensive prices that not only include hosting, but also include this amazing, powerful CMS that is Squarespace. And the pricing on those are $8 and $16. The $16 gets you the unlimited. And another thing, if you sign up for a full year of Squarespace, they'll actually give you a free domain name as well if you don't yet have your own domain.
Very cool.
So we really encourage everyone to go check out Squarespace. We'd love for you to try it for 14 days. You'll be absolutely amazed whether you want a personal blog, whether you want to build a full-blown website. Even if you're a designer and you do this work for your clients, you can use Squarespace to do the work. It'll make your life much easier. So go check them out, squarespace.com/trek, and use offer code TREK12.
The random aspect of our life.
Bridge to Harrison. Bridge to Harrison. Harrison. Wait, Greg, are you John Harrison?
I am. I thought I was John Harriman, but apparently I am John Harrison, who is completely different. Yes, I think we're all, if you look close enough, deep inside, we're all John Harrison.
I guess so. But apparently Benedict Cumberbatch is actually Benedict Cumberpatch, which if you saw the IGN interview with him and Alice Eve, when they put his name up on the screen, they actually wrote Benedict Cumberpatch with a P.
Patch, really? Oh,
John
goodness.
Harrison from Star Trek Into Darkness. So anyway, Greg, we're going to get into our whole huge bag of movie news here. Now, you have seen, I can't see it, I have no way to see it, you have seen the 9-minute preview at the beginning of the Hobbit IMAX.
Yes, so I went to see The Hobbit for the third time this weekend. I went today to see it in IMAX 3D so that I could be sure to see the Into Darkness preview, which is an interesting thing. Like, a lot of people saw it last week, and there were some reports put up about it because I think they showed it to people who went to Bad Robot for that behind-the-scenes look. But they were promising that there's a spoiler in this that we're not going to reveal because JJ told us not to reveal it. And then Friday, the screening started, and I didn't hear anybody talking about the IMAX preview. Like, I really wasn't seeing any of it. Like, I was, you know, I was avoiding the main websites with, like, reports of it because I didn't want to know just, like, everything that happens. But I was kind of expecting an explosion on Twitter where people are talking about it like they were talking about the trailer. And I didn't really see that. And I was wondering why. And then I went to go see it today. And I think I kind of understand why. Not that much happens in the first 9 minutes of the film. Like, you think back to the first 9 minutes of, or I mean, it's more like the first 15 minutes, but of Space Adventure 2009, and it's all about meeting George Kirk and the fight with Nero, and it's this big emotional thing. It's probably the best part of the film. That's not the first 9 minutes of Into Darkness, apparently. The first 9 minutes, well, there's part of it where you've got Mickey, I'm sorry, Noel Clark, who's apparently playing a character not Mickey from Doctor Who, and he and his wife kind of go see their daughter at the hospital, and she's sick, and there's a lot of wow, yes, their daughter is quite sick, it appears. And then out of nowhere comes Benedict Cumberbatch, who says, I can save her. And then cut to, they're on a planet and they're trying to save the villagers from a volcano. And that's the other half of it. And it's like, well, okay, wasn't anything terribly emotional. It does end with Spock in, like, in danger. Like, Spock's willing to sacrifice himself. He actually uses the line, the needs of the many outweigh the needs, or the needs of the many, yeah, outweigh the needs of the few. And they sort of say, no, don't be stupid, Spock. We're going to try to save you somehow. And then it ends in that moment of high tension. But it's not, it's just not much, you know? Hmm. It feels like, okay, this is a thing. It's just not extremely impressive. Nothing revealed at all, for sure. It's just, here's the sets, and here's 3D, and here's, you know, this is what Star Trek looks like shot in IMAX and converted to 3D, but it's just, it's not that big a deal, which is kind of disappointing to me.
Do you believe that this really is the first 9 minutes of the movie, or is this an early cut of the first 9 minutes, or is this just another, it's going to change by the time it comes out?
Well, they did say specifically this is an early cut. You know, they're still 6 months from release, 5 months from release. They can change it, and they probably will change it.
Probably will,
I don't think it's going to change hugely, though. It seems like a necessary thing.
Do you think this is a new way of doing a test audience? Like, let's do the first 9 minutes and throw it out there and see how people react to it, and then let's fix it up.
I definitely do. After Dark Knight Rises, and they released the opening of that film. I don't know if you've seen DKR yet, but it opens with this sort of Bond-esque airplane ballet, airplane battle, and Bane is there. And the reason I'm bringing it up is Bane's, they did a 9-minute preview before the film came out, just like with this, and Bane's voice was almost impossible to understand. They were using Tom Hardy doing kind of like a rough Cockney accent, and it was weirdly amplified, and people complained. We can't understand what he's saying. And after like a couple of days of saying, no, that's what Bane's voice sounds like, you're going to have to deal with it, they completely acquiesced. And in the final film, his voice is completely different. You can understand him much more clearly. And I think if they hadn't done that preview, they would have been up the creek by the time the film came out, because people would have been complaining, we have no idea what Bane says at any point, and they wouldn't have had a way to change it. So I hope that they're going to take some of the feedback, although I'm just not hearing it. I hope they're taking that people aren't really excited and realize maybe they need to start the film with a little bit more exciting of a sequence.
Yeah, yeah, right. And it's kind of important to understand what the characters in a movie are saying. So I'm glad that they made right. that change.
And to be clear, there was no audio problems. There was nothing like majorly wrong. It's just, why are we looking at these people in a hospital that we've never met? Why are they on this volcano planet? It was just like, and especially seen by itself. It's like, this is just not, I want to get to the actual film.
Well, if you watch the Blu-ray commentary with JJ and all the guys from Space Adventure 2009, you know, you find out that they made quite a few modifications to the beginning of that film, which resulted in us getting that very action-packed opening that really just grabbed you and yanked you into the film. And it could have been different if they hadn't realized the need to tighten things up.
I think, and I hope they do something like that here. At least open it with the volcano scene and not with the hospital scenes. I feel like it's not that smart an idea to open the film with an alarm clock. It's not a dynamic opening. I'm sorry. Like, it's like if they've started the film with the Corvette scene from 2009. It's like, that's not the best part of your film. Maybe that's not the opening you should go for.
I think you secretly want a Corvette, Greg. You talk about that Corvette scene an awful lot.
I don't like that Corvette scene. But it was cool, but a lot cooler than the IMAX preview is just the trailer we got, which still, I don't think you've seen yet, Chris, because of...
Well, I've seen the trailer. Well, I've seen the teaser trailer. I haven't seen the
teaser.
There's a new trailer, though, right?
The actual trailer that was released with The Hobbit, which I've now seen 3 times as well. Well, no, I've seen it twice, and then like half of it is shown after the 9 minutes in IMAX. It's really good. It's like a really, really phenomenal trailer. And I hope you do get to see it soon. I can't even tell you. I can't walk you through what's in it because it's just bam, 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 bam. So much excitement, so much cool stuff.
Yeah, my understanding is that tomorrow it will be online and I'll actually be able to see it. Now, we're recording this show. The show comes out on Tuesdays usually, but we record it on what would be Sunday for you guys in the States and Monday for me here in my
So by the time you're listening to this, you can probably... Yeah. Go see the trailer on Apple.com or StarTrekMovie.com. It's probably there. I've only seen it the couple times I could see it in the theater. Chris hasn't really had a chance. So hopefully next week we can have more of a detailed, you know, analysis of the trailer. We get more of the same of what's in the announcement trailer with a little bit more of excitement. And basically just showing more of the characters. And there's a really good voiceover from Pike that is like half the trailer is him giving this speech. And it's just powerful, as powerful gets.
Now, in other bits of news related to this that came out, Cumberbatch, or as we're calling him, what, Jumberbatch?
Jumberbatch, yes. Well, we got that image. It was like Monday. It was another case of we record the show and then something happens and then we release the show. Thanks, Paramount. So we get this image of Cumberbatch in what looks like a brig and Quinto and Pine there looking at him. And we got the image first and everybody was kind of excited. Oh, look, he's wearing a Starfleet uniform. At least he's got the Delta Shield logo on his black shirt. And then everyone looked at the metadata of the picture, which explains Benedict Cumberbatch as John Harrison. Not Gary Mitchell, not Khan Noonien Singh, not Harry Mudd or Henry Mudd or any of the Mudd brothers, and definitely not Charlie X. No, no, no. John Harrison.
Yeah. Do you think, I was watching earlier the interview that John Burbach and Carol Eve, who's playing Dr. Alice Marcus in the movie.
No, it's what did Larry Nemechek keeps calling her, or was saying Mary, was it Mary Marcus? Or no, yeah. Mary Daner. Keeps calling Mary her Mary Daner. Daner. Yeah. That's a brand new character.
So I was watching the interview that they gave to IGN, I believe it was, earlier. And I have to say, I was really impressed with, just like I've seen him deny things in the past, I was really impressed at how well he talks about his character and the name John Harrison, as if that's actually the name of the character in the movie.
Right. Which, okay, I totally believe that he's going to call himself John Harrison for a good period of the film. I'm even hoping that they can manage to keep everything else under wraps until release day. But do I think he's actually John Harrison? I do not. I very much believe it is a pseudonym that he's giving before it's revealed who he actually is. And I'm not entirely sure why he would be giving a pseudonym. You were saying before the show, on the other side of the room...
The other side of the room.
Who you think he is, based on the fact that he's using a pseudonym.
Well, yeah. I don't necessarily think this is who he is, but as it has been pointed out, Harrison is the name of a character in Space Seed. And so, you know, it made me think, like, maybe he actually is Khan... And JJ and the guys are using this name Harrison to represent Khan and not actually reveal it's Khan. But I don't know. I don't necessarily think it's Khan because I don't see how that fits really. Yeah.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, he does say I've returned. You know, I've come back. Now Khan did leave Earth in the Eugenics Wars. He is coming back, but that doesn't connect with me in terms of like a personal issue with Kirk himself or anything. So I'm not sure that it actually works.
I wanted to talk about, if we're going to talk about Khan for a moment, John Tenuto, friend of the show, has an article up on Trek Movie where he gives the case for why he thinks it might be Khan. And I can real quick run down his list of reasons. Mm-hmm. First one is that John Harrison is obviously superpowered, just like Khan. Yeah. Then he says... A Khan by any other name, what he's talking about is the name is kind of close to Khan. John, Khan. Harrison is similar to Erickson, which was a name they were thinking of going with for Khan early on. Yeah. Okay, I'm not sold yet. The next one is the clothes make the Khan, based on a shot from the teaser trailer where he's got a jacket with like a ribbed collar. Like Khan's.
Yeah.
Another one is that Alice Eve is apparently, based on the Bad Robot trip, playing Carol Marcus. And if you're going to have Carol Marcus, you're going to have Khan. And the other one is that Khan's a big name. So they want to have a big name in the film. Okay, so far, I'm not sold at all. I'm really not sold.
Either.
No, Khan, none of those got me.
Khan is super... powered in the sense that he has great physical strength and stamina, and mentally he is superpowered compared to us, but he doesn't have like psychokinetic magical powers that this character apparently has.
Well, where he says to Mickey, I can save your daughter. How is Khan going to save a little girl who's sick?
Right. That's something that I think Gary Mitchell could do.
I think absolutely Gary Mitchell could do. The releasing of a name makes me just believe it's Gary Mitchell. Now, I don't understand. Maybe he'll call himself John Harrison until Kirk finds him. And then he's like, Gary, you're Gary. Why are you calling yourself John? What's going on here?
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, it's possible he's changed his face to hide. Maybe he'll rip off his mask and they'll have a CG version of the original series actor who played Gary Mitchell underneath.
It's kind of like a Mission Impossible mask.
Is yes, exactly. Here? So I guess that's possible.
At this point, I don't know what to think. I will say that I'm glad that it's not as flat and two-dimensional. The approach that they're taking in this movie, they're clearly not doing a remake of something that we've seen before. They are using characters that we know, but I think they're using them in a completely different way. And so I am glad to see that anyway. And
yeah.
And Alice Eve is playing Carol Marcus. She talks about it in the interview with IGN.
Okay.
Specifically. So it's not just from the trailer, but it's she said she's glad it's out in the open now. It's really hard to keep a secret. But I have to say, she's much better at keeping secrets than Simon Pegg is, apparently.
Yes, quite. Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I'm glad that she is Carol rather than Mary. It's not Mary. It's what is Daner? Elizabeth. Rather than Daner. Mainly because that means Kirk gets a love interest, and that's a great thing to have in this film. Because the first one was so much about Spock and Spock's loss and Spock's relationship with Uhura. All Kirk got was the Green Lady and then his sort of infatuation with Uhura. So let's give him his own love interest. Let's have her be this powerful, smart character who hopefully does more than just hug Kirk all the time. That's a cool place because I want this movie to be more about Kirk than the first one was.
Yeah. Yeah. So while we're talking about John Harrison here, just for a moment, John Berbatch here, he came out and he was talking about his character a little bit, and he said his character is a terrorist. And then I also, you know, JJ talked about this a little bit as well, about the character. And it actually reminded me of our discussion last week about Dukat and when we were talking about two-dimensional versus three-dimensional villains. Mm-hmm. And what John Berbatch here talks about is the fact that Harrison is not a cookie-cutter villain, that he's a very multidimensional character, and in the vein of all great villains, you know, in his eyes, he is on the right side. You know, he has justifications for why he's doing things in his own mind anyway, and he's not just being evil. He's not just coming to destroy Earth or blow up the fleet and everything that it stands for and all this stuff. You know, it's like he has an agenda. He has a mission that in his mind is for good. And so the result of it is that we may get a very interesting story here and not simply a very shallow Enterprise crew has to save the world from evil villain kind of story.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a tweet going around, got a lot of retweets about how Star Trek movie villains are always out for revenge. But then I went back and I thought about it, and okay, there's Wrath of Khan, certainly. And then there's, remind me the other ones, where there's a guy out for revenge?
Of course, I'm going to go in random order, as I think. So Generations, we have... Well, Sorin is not actually out for revenge, really. I mean,
right.
He has this vendetta against the Borg because his family was killed. But what he really wants isn't to destroy the Borg. He just wants to get back to the Nexus.
Right.
Nemesis, we have Shinzon, which I never thought really worked because he wants to destroy Earth and all the Federation worlds. But as for why,
yeah,
they rarely made a good case to me for right. why so, that was happening.
So Shinzon didn't have great motivation. The Borg were always out for... They've always been out for assimilation. It wasn't really revenge. If anything, it was
Picard
wanting revenge, which, okay, that's
yes.
cool. Yes, Insurrection had a theme of revenge because yeah, they were
true.
The children yeah. coming back. Most of the films really just don't have it. Okay, so that's step one. Step two is... It really doesn't sound like John Berbatch is out for revenge. We may have that Russian title, Vengeance, possibly might be the title. I don't speak Russian, so I'm not going to argue. But it may be Vengeance. And he talks about how he's returned. But it really sounds like he's out for something bigger than that, bigger than vengeance. He wants to make a change. And that's why he's a terrorist. Like, vengeance is someone like on a one-track mind, I want to defeat this person. Whereas it sounds like he's doing something much more subtle, which is really cool in my eyes.
Yeah, he says that it's personal, it's also political. And he's somebody who at some point in the film, you should feel a certain amount of empathy towards his cause, if not his means, because there's no two-dimensional obstacle that he presents purely and simply by the fact that he is opposing our hero. So he has some agenda that goes beyond simple personal vengeance.
Yeah, yeah. So that'll be really cool. I still do kind of hope that it's revealed by the end that he's actually not John Harrison. He is, in fact, the Fire Drake Smaug.
Could be. And then there's that great scene where he faces off with the whale probe.
Yes.
Above Earth in the final battle.
I was trying to figure out a way that it could be like the dragon probe who's come back to find out what's happened to all the dragons. And John Harrison's actually trying to go back in time to bring Smaug back to modern day so that he can meet. And then the dragon ends up detonating the fleet kind of by accident. Like, it didn't even mean to. He just sort of sneezed on Starfleet.
Sneezed. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. That could be the case. Now, I think he should bring back two dragons so he can repopulate the species, but... Yeah,
that maybe could that's get the really, problem. Well, maybe that's what happens to London. Is there's just two dragons going at it?
Could be. All right. Well, on the same topic here, this is from a different interview. This is actually from the interview that they did with IGN UK. And Alice Eve was talking about Harrison, and she said, "I think the interesting thing about the film is that it presents two moral structures." So it isn't just as black and white as good versus evil. It's which morality do you subscribe to and the three-dimensional problems on either side. So there's many layers of ethical and personal quandaries that you come up against that makes it less easy to walk away being clear about, I hate that man. And it really does sound just like our conversation last week.
Yeah, it really does, which is really cool. I guess what I'm waiting to see is what is this philosophy he has that causes him to detonate the Starfleet and all it stands for. And that does make me think of Cybok, who was out to meet God, and whatever he did was for that purpose, because he thought that was so much more important than lives or anything else that was sacrificed along the way. What is this moral idea that he's putting forward that we could possibly agree with, or at least side with, not considering his methods? That'll remain to be seen. And how it ties into him being a canon villain, I really don't know.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, they've done a great job of keeping us all puzzled and getting us interested. And so I am looking forward to that. Now, two more quick points here before we wrap up movie news. JJ, this was another interview that he did with MTV. And I was watching this one as well. And actually, if you watch the video, it comes off a little bit differently than it does in writing, because I first read about his comments saying that this movie was not made for Star Trek fans.
Right.
And in writing on the sites where I saw it, it was presented, whether intentionally or unintentionally, it came off as being presented as JJ kind of thumbing his nose at Star Trek fans and saying, like, I don't care about Star Trek fans. I'm just making a movie and it's not made for the fans. And that's not really what he was saying. He was saying that, first and foremost, this movie is made for movie fans, but there's a lot of stuff in this movie for Star Trek fans, and there are a lot of nods to Star Trek canon as well, you know, that people will pick up on. How do you feel about this? I think it's our concern, like, that JJ is not making Star Trek movies. He's just making movies wrapped in Star Trek clothing. I mean, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think JJ needs to be really careful when he says things like this. Like, yeah. He's on thin ice with a a large spectrum of Star Trek fans who already think he's ruined the franchise with the first film and is on the way to ruining it even more. And he just shouldn't say stuff like, this isn't a film for Star Trek fans. He should word it differently. And the rest of what he says is great, that he's making it for movie fans. He wants the, you not have to rely on knowing the character before coming into the film. Like, that's a good thing. Like, he's going to develop this villain fully inside of the film, that you're going to be able to understand his motivations, even if you know nothing else about Star Trek. I think that's really important. I'm going to, you know, as a test, take with me a friend who's never seen any of Star Trek before, certainly didn't see the last film, and see how they were able to follow it, see if they were interested, or see if it just didn't work at all. Because, yeah, I mean, you take someone to see Nemesis, who has no connection to Star Trek, and they're going to hate the film even more than we do. Like, that film was only carried along by our love for the original material and these characters. But as a, you know, as a film that someone who doesn't know anything about Star Trek is going to come in and watch, it's really not that good. So I like that JJ's thinking about that and trying to make a movie, because we want Star Trek to make money. And if it can make money and please fans at the same time, which is what JJ seems to be aiming for, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. I mean, the reality is that Star Trek is designed for television. You know, it's a framework through which you tell ongoing stories on a weekly basis. So I kind of never really hold the movies up to the same standard as that. Like, I don't necessarily, it doesn't bother me if the Star Trek movies are made more for the general audience. And in a way, I think it's a good thing. I think that that's what supports Star Trek overall. That's what brings in new fans. And that's what gets the publicity for Star Trek as well. And I totally agree with him. He said that we couldn't just make the movie just for fans of Star Trek. And I pretty much agree with him on that. I mean, the studio's not going to give him all the money that it takes to make a film like what we're seeing in these trailers if it's just targeting an aging fan base, you know, and nothing against the fan base. I'm a member of that aging fan base myself. But, you know, we need new fans coming in. We need that high-profile exposure in the media that we get from right. something like this. And I actually do think, from what I'm seeing, that this is going to be, at least from the action perspective, a movie that Star Trek fans will appreciate. And it sounds like, from the moral question that's coming into this movie, that it's a movie that Star Trek fans are going to be able to appreciate for the message as well. But everyone's so cautious about it after yeah. the last movie. I don't think anyone will admit this or agree to it until after we've actually seen the movie.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's similar to the way I was kind of very worried about The Hobbit leading into it. And then seeing it now, I'm like, oh, well, no. Jackson knew exactly what he was doing. He made exactly the film he wanted. It works really well. It's great. I think I can just have faith that J.J. Abrams knows what he's doing. From everything I'm seeing, it doesn't look like this is, you know, the half-assed Star Trek. It looks like they're putting every bit of effort into it. And I think now that we're seeing more about it, we can relax a little bit. It looks like we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so. Which leads me to the very last item before we jump into the feature today. And this is Roberto Orsi and Alex Kurtzman saying that JJ's involvement in Star Trek is probably going to be limited to a trilogy. Now, do you Right. think this is a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it was an inevitable thing. You know, directors want to do more with their life than stick with one franchise, especially something they didn't create themselves. I mean, how many movies did Nicholas Meyer direct? He directed two of them, and they were years apart. I can't tell you the exact years. What, 11 years? 9 years apart. And Leonard Nimoy did two of them. It doesn't surprise me at all. I think Jonathan Frakes did two. So doing three would be more than any other director has stuck with Star Trek before, unless you count, you know, TV episodes.
Yeah, okay, so that's a good point in terms of JJ himself. What they also say, though, is they're not talking about simply JJ, but they're talking about Bad Robot. And Orsi says that, I think in our minds, we always thought that we'd probably start outliving our usefulness after three movies. That's a nice three-act structure for whatever story you're telling. So the way I read that is that this whole reboot, Abrams versus Experiment, is probably going to be limited to three movies. And then Star Trek will continue. I mean, I think Star Trek is going to be around, certainly in our lifetimes. Star Trek is always going to be around in some incarnation. And it is going to come back eventually in live action as well. And of course, we have it in comics and in novels. How do you see this? What is the place of this Abramsverse in the overall big picture of Star Trek if it's limited to a trilogy, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard thing for me to say. I think if they just abandon it after three films and don't do any more, I'll be really disappointed. I think they've put together a great cast. I think doing a trilogy is great, and then do more. It doesn't necessarily have to be the Bad Robot people making it. The universe itself can continue with the same cast. It is a weird thing where they've sort of handed it over to a studio. You know, it almost feels like it's really high-profile fan films, especially the way StarTrek.com treats it, where they're putting up a news article. Oh, we just found out that the villain's name is John Harrison. Isn't that interesting?
Right.
Let's publish an article where we have a fan speculating. It's like they don't even know what's going to happen. So it's a weird place that Star Trek is right now. And
it is.
I don't know. What do you do next? Do you hand it over to Wingnut Studios and let Peter Jackson make three Star Trek films? What is the plan after this? Do they even have a plan? And I really don't know. I would be extremely surprised if J.J. Abrams makes four, if Alex Kurtzman and Damon Lindelof and Roberto Orsi are writing four films. But then Michael Bay never planned to make four Transformers films, and yet there's a fourth one on its way. So things can change. It depends on how the next couple movies go. I guess, big picture, I will be extremely disappointed if this J.J. universe does not continue. I want to keep seeing movies in this universe. I want to see TV shows in this universe. They've put Star Trek on a great path for the 21st century. And I really hope Paramount doesn't let that stop just because JJ's bored with it and wants to move on to the next thing.
The year 1999 brought us the Y2K bug, Will Smith sampling The Clash, and the new Manium. It also brought us the Millennium Gate and the story of Captain Janeway's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother in the uniquely named 1159. And as we near the end of another year, we're going to talk about this episode. To help us do that, we have with us our managing editor and Voyager editor, Mistress Charlene Schmidt. Hello, Char.
Hey, how's it going? Why are you laughing?
And we have with us, apparently, still from Bride of Chaotica, Satan's robot, Matthew Rushing.
I just haven't had time to change it. I'm sorry. But are we sure this isn't like a U2 song? Like,
right.
I'm wondering. That or maybe a Coldplay song?
No, please. The former, not the latter.
Yes, could it please be? It is a strange title. Like, why is it called? Why? Because we don't even go up to midnight. I kept waiting for them to.
No, we do.
Does it go right up?
Yeah, they do.
Oh, that's right.
Well, at 11:59, he comes out and turns the sign over.
It's the 11th hour change at the very end. Okay, I just was more expecting a New Year's party to start at any moment.
That was the
everybody's wearing like 2,000 glasses, and they've got champagne, and there's confetti everywhere.
The party was going to start later. when, you know, he turns over the sign and him and Shannon actually get together. And
this is true. There's some champagne.
They make some sweet, sweet love.
They make love in France.
Yeah. You know, she lets Jason have the computer, make sure he puts in the headphones, and
yeah, and then,
they get down to business. So,
yeah, that is when they celebrate.
Yeah, okay. This did not take long to take a left turn.
No, it didn't.
No.
Well, hello, I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking.
I am here to corrupt your podcast.
Char's back for the first time in a couple of weeks, and look where we are right now at the 4-minute mark.
Surprise.
Although I have to say that Matthew started this in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
That is true. It's your fault.
Come on, guys. You're ruining my rep here.
All right.
What rep?
So, you know, I was thinking that this was called 11:59. Because that's the amount of time in this episode that is spent on what the story is supposed to be about. And the rest of the episode is spent going back to the ship so they can play with astrometrics and do all their Voyager technology stuff that they always do.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Should we just touch upon this point right off the bat, Chris? Because I think we were talking briefly on the other side of the room about how this part of the story on Voyager really wasn't that necessary.
Yeah.
I have an idea for a rewrite on this, and that is, it starts off just fine. It's perfectly fine up through that first scene on Voyager, where Janeway and Seven are talking a little bit. Then you have the next scene where it ties in with Neelix and Tom Paris talking, kind of competing with one another about history, how much their knowledge is or is not, whatever. Okay, fine, that's a cute tie-in. Wrap that up, get it over with, because it's not that great. And then cut back to 21st century, or the verge of the 21st century, if you will. And then don't cut back to Voyager until the very end. I propose you cut out everything up until Janeway and Chakotay are talking, and then patch in the scene where they're taking the photo. Done. That's the episode.
Really?
Yes.
See, for me, this is how I think. You need the little intro on the ship. Very briefly, just to get them into the story, the whole story takes place in Indiana. It's all about Shannon. And then the story ends with the scene when they come back to Voyager and Janeway is sitting on her sofa staring out the window. That's the end of the episode.
Oh, so you're really talking about paring it down. Okay.
Well, I understand what both of you are saying, but for me personally, what I liked about this episode is that it was a character episode, and I got to know these characters in a way that I had never before, because they stopped doing techno babble and they start just talking about themselves. And so, you know, Chris, I know you don't love the scene, but I love the scene when they're sitting in Janeway's quarters, just telling stories, because this is what Voyager would actually be like a lot of the time. They're not going to be fighting an alien every 5 minutes, and they're not going to have an anomaly every 5 minutes. Space is huge. The Delta Quadrant is huge. So there's a lot of downtime. You know, at the beginning of the episode, Janeway says, well, there's only, you know, we'll be there in like 2 weeks or whatever, she says. And so they have all this time where they're not really doing anything, and they just get a chance to share a part of themselves with each other. And I really, really like that, because Voyager never takes time to really show us characters. But this time, not only did they show us, but then they kind of told us some of their backstories. And, you know, poor dumb Harry had a poor dumb uncle who was just as dumb as Harry is.
He sure did.
You know, and so I can understand now. It runs in the family.
Very true.
Yeah. I mean, the episode reminds me of some of the great moments in Firefly, where you're just learning more about people and you're just telling stories around the kitchen table. It's the sort of relaxing, you sometimes a show can relax, and it doesn't have to be bam, 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 excitement, techno babble. And just like Matthew, I love that scene where they're all just sitting around, you know, drinking hot cocoa, talking about where they come from. I know, Chris, you were complaining about how the doctor comes in and starts talking about how he's related to a... I love that. I love that moment so much.
You love that moment. I totally get what you guys are saying about character development. And I think, Matthew, as you told me on iMessage, I think it was, that maybe you were so hungry for character development in Voyager that when they threw these little morsels out there, you just grabbed them up because it was all that you got. And The thing is, I totally agree with you guys that the show should have relaxed more and we should have had more of these moments, but I think they needed to be interspersed. I feel like this episode needed to focus on Janeway and focus on Shannon.
I agree.
And it should have been about Janeway learning about her ancestor and for us as the viewer to take away. I feel like we're doing our final thoughts at the beginning here, so we'll get out of this in a second. But and the reason I think it should have ended with him closing the store and they cut back to the ship and Janeway staring out the window is we as the viewer can take what it means to us and what we think Janeway is gaining from this exploration of her ancestor. I felt like the ending with everyone in the mess hall and doing the photo. And what is Happy Ancestors Day or what is this?
It's a stupid made-up holiday by Neelix.
It's like
Neelix's fault.
That, for me, felt like the Disney ending. You know, I've often complained about Disney releases Miyazaki movies in the States, and the big one for me is Spirited Away, where they basically negate the entire movie by giving Sen a line at the end of the movie where there isn't one in Japanese. Yeah. And I feel like this is Braga and Minoski telling us that, like, here's what you're supposed to take away from this episode. I don't want that as a viewer. I want to come to my own conclusion.
See, what I took from that is Neelix would see everything that's going on and come up with a stupid party. Like, that's what Neelix
would
do.
True.
And everyone just kind of goes along with it because they like Neelix. He's fun.
He's the morale officer. That is what he does.
Yeah, so no one's going to complain and say, no, we're not going to have Ancestors Day, Neelix. That's stupid.
Well,
go back
to
your quarters.
I mean, think about your office. I mean, if your boss said, hey, you know, we're going to have like a happy printer paper day next Friday, and we're gonna order pizza, we're going to have cake, and we're going to have wine at noon. Would you complain? No,
is David
of course
Brent
not.
In this offense?
Yes, or Michael Scott?
Yeah.
A Voyager party is the best because a Voyager party don't stop.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
You know, Chris, I think you're right, though. I mean, and I was, you know, Voyager starts with a lot of potential. And we talked about this with Kirsten Beyer when she was on. And Voyager's characters have a ton of potential, but they're never given that. And so this is one of those moments where character won over ridiculous technobabble. And I was so hungry for that because I had been so spoiled with Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine had been the filet mignon of Star Trek, and I was left with, you know, this crappy original McDonald's hamburger. It was Voyager. And, you know,
and they forgot to put the pickles on.
Yeah, where they forgot to put the pickles on, and it was just double onions. And so what I wanted was, this was more like they finally gave me, you know, a half-ass steak. And
McDonald's?
I appreciated that they tried with this episode. And you're right, they could have done it so much better.
Yeah. So let's jump in. And let me just say, too, before the listeners think I'm just bashing here, I actually really like this episode. I think it's a very good episode. And it's a great episode of Voyager. So I don't hate this episode or anything. I was just kind of, when I was watching it this time especially, I had a little bit different take on it, and I was kind of disappointed in some directions. But so, Greg, why don't we jump in and talk more about the episode?
Yeah, so I want to talk about how this episode takes my favorite trope from Star Trek, and that is a character or an actor playing their character's ancestor. We had that with T'Pol playing her ancestor in Carbon Creek. Of course, Brent Spiner does it as Soong and then plays Arik Soong in Enterprise. I think it's been done other times. You guys might have to remind me. This is like the time Voyager did it, where let's just have Kate play just a normal person in modern day. It's not like, what was the episode, Future's End, where they go back in time. And it's weird and awkward. This
is
just
Los Angeles. Yeah.
Yeah. We're seeing a different side of Janeway because it's not really Janeway. And that's just so much fun. I like time. I like when Star Trek can do time travel without it being time travel, we can talk about how they were thinking of doing this episode. It's not anybody going back in time. It's just let's see a story. Let's see something happen in Star Trek that's not the people on the starship. And that's
right.
And so that's just at the very beginning. That gets me excited about this episode. That makes me happy. And then there's so much more to go from there, but I'll let somebody else take it.
One of the things I was noticing about the episode is what Kate's able to do with her character, in that she gives Shannon little pieces of what you would think of as being Catherine Janeway, you know, and the little hints of this character that's going to kind of live on from this ancestor. You know, what really lasts, whether or not she was this great woman that Catherine thinks she is, her character was so strong that it lives on, and it influences Catherine in such a huge way. And I thought that was really interesting to watch her get to actually play that strong character and really work with that and mold that and make that into something that, like Greg was saying, you are really excited to watch. And man, Kate can act like crazy, and I loved that in this episode because, one, she looks great. In you know, the past, as this ancestor, but two, she is very different than Catherine in a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways that we might be like, ooh, she's just not as you know, strong and loyal and all the things we come to know about Janeway that we really love.
I feel like
it's great.
Yeah, we're expecting to see Catherine Janeway telling this story about her noble ancestor, and see her do all these amazing things and be an astronaut and build the Millennium Gate. And then we don't get that at all. We see this woman in like a beat up Volvo or something, beat up Toyota on the highway, and it's raining. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing reality.
Yeah, which is great. I'm glad that they took, because the normal approach would be, like you said, for Janeway to tell the story of her noble ancestor. That's the very, I think, typical, especially for Voyager, way of storytelling. And here's a case, I think it was wonderful to see her real ancestor without all the, you know, making her all prettied up.
One of my very favorite parts of this episode is where we go from Janeway bragging about Shannon O'Donnell and all of her these grand accomplishments that she made, and then we cut to Shannon O'Donnell in her real life, and she's in the beat-up station wagon using a tape recorder for her diary. This is not quite the glamorous life that Catherine Janeway thinks her ancestor had. She's a very real person, has some very real problems. I mean, her car breaks, she's got no money, and she's out of a job. Definitely not quite the idolized person that history made her out to be, whether it was through exaggeration by Aunt Martha, or if simply records got misplaced or were deleted, missing, whatever. Things did not kind of translate terribly well over time, and so Catherine's version of this woman is very different from what she really was. But as you said, Matt, what really matters is the character, who this woman really was. The rest of it is just kind of minor details.
It was really interesting watching the episode too, because I felt like it was as fresh now as it was when I watched it, because a lot of the issues that this woman is facing, a lot of people are facing, especially in the States and around the world, you know, jobs going away, not being able to find one, kind of feeling lost and directionless. And so watching this, I was thinking, you know, a lot of people were facing this at the turn of the millennium. My God, we're still facing these same issues. You know,
maybe worse.
13 years later, and so I felt like this. It was, for me, it's something that it was just as poignant now as it was then, and hopefully, let's just say, hopefully that our future can get brighter. You know, let's start creating our own Millennium Gates. You know, let's move forward instead of, you know, living in the past as we have been.
Right. Yep. And I find this episode inspirational in that sense. And I know it's not a holiday episode, but it does take place between Christmas and New Year's. So I always
watch
it. It feels
like a holiday episode, though.
Yeah, it's always, I always watch it at this time of year, just kind of for that reason. It puts me in the mood and puts me really in the holiday spirit, to be quite honest. And no, really. So that's kind of what I get from it. It's kind of my, yeah. Like, some people will watch It's a Wonderful Life. I watch 1159.
This is why, yeah, this is why every year Barnes & Noble has to kick Char out of the store at 1159.
Right.
Yes.
Like, you just like got to leave now. Look, we're closing.
Yeah,
just,
we're closed. Just, right. Just like Alexandria Books.
So there's a story that this episode reminds me of, a real life story about Macy's in the 60s, wanting to build this huge circular department store in Queens. I don't know if you've seen the plans for the Apple spaceship campus. This is a lot like that. They basically bought up all these houses that were in Queens, and they went to build this huge department store. And one house held out. It was this house that was bought in the 20s for like $4,000. And Macy's kept upping their offer and upping it and upping it, upping it. And they eventually offered her $200,000 in the 60s just Whoa. For her house.
Wow.
And she absolutely refused to sell. So they had to change their plan. They had to restructure the whole plan to build around the house. So there's pictures of this little tiny house next to this giant building because she was the last holdout. And she stayed there mm-hmm. until she died in the 80s. At which
wow.
point her kids sold the house.
She and Henry Janeway should have gotten
I know.
Together.
See, they yeah, no should have kidding. Gotten together, not this Shannon lady who... Because that's the thing about this episode. We're talking about defying expectations. First, there's Janeway. We think it's going to go in a certain way, where Janeway's going to tell us about her heroic ancestor. But then I think we're expecting Henry to win for this horrible... monstrosity of a Millennium Gate to just not get built, or it gets built somewhere else, and Henry, that one man against the machine. But the show is saying something completely different too here, where it's kind of saying Henry's not right. Sometimes progress is progress. Sometimes the massive mall is the way we should go, which is not where the sort of story usually goes. Or at least,
well, I don't know if it's not, quite that.
Even taking that out, I think it's just that, you know, sometimes you have to let go and you have to move forward. That's at the most basic level what the message is of this story.
The message I got was that progress is compromise, because that's what Shannon and Henry end up doing in the end. He's stuck in the past with his books. She's kind of stuck in the future with her rocket ship. And I think she says in the episode itself, but maybe we can be together in the present. We can converge in the present and make that work.
Right.
Together.
That's what Matthew was talking about earlier. They were converging in the present right after
exactly.
midnight.
Right after they cut the black.
They converged all right.
It was just a more, intimate version of converging.
Well, they had to converge in several different ways. That was the first.
Yeah, exactly.
There were a lot of kids in that photo at the end.
They converged a lot.
Yeah, they were busy.
There's a lot of convergence going on there.
Yeah.
You know, though, I think it was interesting just kind of the discussion we're having about, you know, expectations and change and all that kind of thing. And to me, it seems like that Henry was stuck in that idea of idolizing the past as if it's actually better. And I love the conversation they have in the bar about, you know, the whether or not it created the greatest literature and everything. And then she goes, cold beer. And he's like, oh, you got me there. You know?
Yeah.
But we have this idea that, you know, people like to think that, oh, the 50s were the heyday. You know, that's when everything was good and moral and great, you know. But think of all the problems that existed there, you know, or, you know, go back farther. You know, who wants to live in medieval times when, you know, everybody dies when they're like 35 and, you know, dysentery runs wild. And I mean, idolizing the past doesn't do any good. And it also negates us learning the lessons from the past. And I think that that's what Henry wasn't able to do. And what Shannon is having a problem with is just kind of being somebody who runs away from things when they get bad.
Right.
And they're both able to help each other see what their problems are. And I mean, this is the beauty of, you know, marriage and good relationship, is that we help each other become better people.
Exactly.
And so that was what makes this relationship really work. I think that's what makes it really beautiful, because we don't see that a lot on television, is people actually helping each other become better people. and really love each other instead of just being selfish jerks. And I'm going to use this relationship for whatever I can get out of it. And sorry, that was kind of a soapbox, but
absolutely. No, that was good.
That's a really good point, though.
O'Donnell, Janeway, you know, she learns that she needs to not just run to the next place. And Henry learns that he needs to not be so stuck in the past. And there's not like a huge villain. Like even the guy from the company, he's not really villainous. He's like, well, we'd really love to build it here because it'd be the best place. But if we can't, I guess we'll build it somewhere else. And I like that it's a more realistic image of the world. Like you say, it's a Wonderful Life. But even that ends kind of silly at the end. And it's not a realistic ending where everyone sort of says, well, I guess if we all compromise, we'll all turn out well in the end. It's a, yay, now everyone's happy because things are good. Like, there wasn't this Harry Potter ending to this episode, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, no, it was very realistic. Definitely.
And it's a good point, Matthew, I mean, about idolizing the past. I think it's human nature. I think we all look back at the past and remember things. The way the mind works, you know, you remember the good things. Mm-hmm. You forget the bad things as time goes by. You know, I'm like that about some things in my life from, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I only remember the very good moments of it. And I sometimes think, like, you know, now things are so much worse than they were. Everything was great at that point in time, when in reality, I may have many of the same problems back then. So I think that what we see here, yeah, it is very realistic. It's very natural, and it's part of human nature. And the resolution to it was quite realistic, which is, again, well, unusual for Voyager.
The heroes that they mention, you know, the Greek heroes, that, you know, these are people who are completely screwed up in a million different ways, you know. So I mean, these are not necessarily people to idolize, you know. The point of Greek myth and whatever was to teach us something about the human nature, and how flawed that we really are, you know. Even, you know, gods and demigods are just as flawed as we are, just on a more massive scale. You know, they can just rip trees out of the ground and smack you with them, but that doesn't make them better. And this idea of hero worship, you know, what we put our faith in has to be able to withhold that faith. And a lot of times the heroes that we look to really can't. And, you know, this is what Janeway learns, is that Catherine Janeway learns, you know, who we put our faith in and what we believe about them, they have to be able to withstand that. And, you know, nobody really can withstand that kind of pressure. You know, this is why people believe in a higher power, because that's the only thing that we can think of that can withstand that kind of pressure. And even then, you know, people don't think so. So I think this episode has tons of great questions, not always great answers, but it has a lot of great questions.
So could we talk for a moment, at least, about the awesome bookstore set that they built? It is such a great place, and it's such a relief to be there rather than the carpeted Starfleet, you know, the Voyager floors and all of that. It's this very realistic feeling location. Like, this whole thing felt like a movie shot on location, but the fact that they built all of this and made it feel so realistic and not cheesy. I mean, look at an episode from the original series set on a you know, a backlot planet. And this was the Paramount backlot, but they, you know, they brought in snow and they built it all up. It feels completely realistic.
It feels very cozy.
Mm-hmm.
It was so realistic, in fact, that there was even that Starbucks back in the corner.
yes.
Well, nice. You know that Shannon O'Donnell was not going to stick around if there wasn't coffee.
They gave her decaf, though. I was surprised she didn't throw it in space.
It was because it was the end of the day. It was evening time. You got to cut off somewhere or you're not going to sleep. So she let that go.
Char, Kathy doesn't cut off anywhere.
This is Shannon O'Donnell we're talking about, not Kathy. Kathy is always at warp speed. Now, Shannon had limits.
Yeah,
I guess.
She had much more moderation than Catherine Janeway when it comes to coffee.
Well,
but
you know,
still loved it.
She's got Henry to scratch her itches. Catherine doesn't have anybody.
Oh, she's got Coco.
That's true.
She does have Coco.
Yeah, that never goes anywhere.
We're not supposed to know about that.
That's on the other side of the ready room.
That's right.
Her ready room.
Keeping that on the down low. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Not this ready room. This is why Harry wears a blinder mask and earplugs when he sleeps.
Because his quarters are right next to Janeway's ready room. Or
well,
something.
Okay, so you're talking about Henry. How amazing was Kevin Tai in this episode? I think a lot of people from our show will know him as Locke's father, the infamous Sawyer on Lost.
Ah, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm pretty sure this is where Lost and Star Trek cross over. I'm pretty sure that somewhere Janeway's related to Sawyer.
Wait, so is really the real end of Voyager where they just meet in that chapel and they realize that this has all really just been a huge dream in purgatory?
That's a better ending than we got for Voyager, so let's go with that. Let's have Admiral Paris lead them all into a white door. That works for me
go.
Better
that's
than
it.
Anything else.
Okay.
But Kevin Tai is great. Like, he does have it's this interesting connection that he immediately has with Janeway as soon as she shows up. It's not I just watched the episode with the pleasure guy. And wow, like that's the other complete end of the spectrum where it's like, please stop touching my captain. Would you just don't do that anymore?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's bad if it's making you uncomfortable watching it. Right. Yes. Whereas this guy, yeah, I mean, I would definitely sit with him and have a cup of coffee. But I kind of want to take this in a slightly different direction for just a moment. Because when I first watched this episode, and it might have something to do with age, I actually thought Shannon O'Donnell and Henry's son, Jason, had a little more chemistry. They had more in common anyway than Shannon and Henry did. However, this time watching it, I'm seeing how their differences balance them as a couple and how that works.
Yeah, right.
And so now I'm thinking, okay, this is great. And then... yeah, she does get along with Jason, and those two, as Henry said, are evil together, and I can just imagine the shenanigans that ensued to make Henry's life miserable, which, hey, that makes for an exciting and fun household, so I see how this works out. It's awesome. It's perfect, actually. I really like it now.
Yeah, I think they work really well together, and they had a chemistry on screen from the moment she walks in the bookstore and she meets him, where you think... okay, there's something kind of electric going on between these two characters. And it makes you feel like they belong together, even though they've known each other for seconds. And that's one of those rare things that just happens on a show. And they really, I think, worked hard, I guess, at getting the right casting for Henry. Because if that storyline doesn't work, this whole episode doesn't work at all.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to watch it.
Yeah.
But watching those two kind of... fight it out and get to that point of resolution, real resolutions. No monkey involved here. Yes. Not even Galliforms are involved. You know, this really works on screen, and the casting was perfect.
I think it was a little weird to give Henry a teenage son. I mean, okay, better than having a monkey. If Henry had a pet monkey around, I would have had more of a problem.
I think Tristan would argue with you there because
he would.
Tristan would probably tell us that this episode would have been twice as good if there had been a monkey in it.
All right. We'll have to discuss this on the next To the Journey.
There you go.
But,
to the Journey!
Go ahead, Greg.
But it was, I'm with Char, that it was a little weird that they had that kind of chemistry. The same thing happens in Carbon Creek where there's the son of the diner owner. The T'Pol kind of has like a lot of chemistry with it. I'm kind of like... yeah, but she's like 80 years old. I shouldn't be shipping them right now. I
Matt is just shaking his head right now.
Oh, I think so Matthew just fell off
the chair.
So many horrible
tailgate thoughts going through his mind right now.
Okay. I get what... all right.
Well, look, someone has to map Carbon Creek or else no one's going to know where to go when the Vulcans come back.
Right. Wasn't that what they were going to hire Janeway to do? Was she was going to go up and map that other city if things didn't go well with Henry? Well,
she was going to map Canton.
Canton, exactly. Isn't Canton where Jane dropped that the chest of gold, and it I'm making a Firefly reference that no one but five people in our audience will get. Jane, the man they call Jane. Anyway, I understand what you're saying, Char, about Henry and Janeway or O'Donnell sort of bouncing out. I never get any sort of like sexual chemistry there or like an actual relationship. Like, okay, he introduces himself and it's like, and I'm Henry Janeway. I'm like, oh, okay, so they're going to get together by the end of the episode because she has to get his name somehow.
Right.
I just felt like they could have just been friends and the story would have turned out the same. Like, she only hangs around because they kind of get along. But like, what? People I get along with, I go to movies. I don't marry them.
I don't.
No, yeah, there was more to it than that. Because really? They have this little dance where she's trying to leave. She's going to go on her way. But, well, no, I think I'll stay for another day. I'm kind of having a good time with you guys. And they get attached rather quickly. There's some sort of connection. And I don't even think they completely know what exactly is going on yet. But they are drawn.
Yeah.
To one another.
And that happens. Yeah. That happens. Like you meet, it's rare. You meet someone though, and there's that spark, there's that connection, and you don't really know why, but it's there. And like with Jason here, and the same thing in Carbon Creek, these teenagers are by their very nature looking towards the future, and they're restless where they are, and they see their families, and their position in life right now is kind of being connected to the past. So when someone like Shannon comes through and, you know, she's an engineer and she talks to him about the moon landing and she's looking to the future, there's a natural superficial connection there. Almost for Jason seeing Shannon as kind of a role model, the same way that Janeway sees Shannon as a role model as her ancestor.
True. Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas with Shannon and Henry, Shannon may be like, Matthew, you said earlier that Shannon's kind of running away, right? Running away from things. But she's been there in the past. So she and Henry have this maybe shared experiences on a deeper level that we can't really see it all play out in this episode because there's not enough time. But that's why I think, too, all these scenes where they keep cutting back to the damn ship over and over and over, let us see Shannon and Henry. And then I think maybe, Greg, for you, that connection might have made more sense because we would have had more meat to the story there.
That could be. That I need to see the extended edition version of this episode where they get more...
Coming on the Blu-ray when they remaster it. Right. We'll get that extra.
With more troll head decapitation and...
Yes.
Yes. Well, they could run across the street to the Starbucks and have a little date where they're talking about something that isn't the damn Millennium Gate the whole time. And yes, maybe I'd see a little bit more of that relationship there.
I also think, too, though, this is a more mature relationship. This is not two teenagers falling in love and the first thing they think of is sex. You know, relationships aren't just sex anyway. And so you need to have that deep and abiding friendship that will carry you through the times when you know, that's not the main thing. And as you get older, it's definitely not the main thing because it just can't happen as much. So they have, I think, that relationship that makes me think, okay, this couple has what it's going to take to make through the tough times to be able to make it, you know. Obviously, I think they have a connection that's going to lead them to have a rounded relationship. But, you know, the main focus obviously isn't, you know, their relative hotness and whether they're going to get it on in 5 seconds.
So it's more like Gandalf and Galadriel than Aragorn and Arwen.
Yes, that kind of like smoldering underneath, you know, the robes relationship.
Hmm. Sure.
Underneath the robes.
Underneath the robes. There's a show title. Thank you, Matthew.
Every damn time.
So... while we're talking about Carbon Creek a little bit, Greg, tell us a little bit more why you see this as a sister show to Carbon Creek, beyond what you just explained, which does fill in some of that for me.
Well, both shows are kind of about history and about the fictionalization of history. And I I really like that. Obviously, Carbon Creek is more T'Pol telling the story, and she tells it however she wants to. And we're never quite clear by the end of that whether we got reality or T'Pol's version of it or some combination of the two.
Right.
But they're both, you know, they're both in a way about the way we think of our ancestors, which I personally don't ever think about my ancestors. I don't know if this is something just particular to my family, but we don't have family stories. And I love families that do. I love hearing that Janeway has this ancestor, and who cares if she actually was an astronaut? Who cares if Bilbo Baggins' great grandfather actually knocked the head clean off of a troll? Like, it's great to have those stories and those inspirational people where it's not like, okay, everyone looks up to Michael Jordan or whoever. It's your own personal hero. And I feel like learning something about a character like that really helps. Ronald D. Moore always told his writing staff on Battlestar, tell me something I don't know about these characters. And this is us learning something about Janeway that you can go back and watch the whole show and remember she's driven forward by this memory of who Shan O'Donnell is. T'Pol wanted to be with these humans because her ancestor came to Earth, and that this family has always had a deep connection to humanity. They've always been curious about humanity. They've kept this handbag for all these years. And that, it just, it makes Janeway more of a character. And you know, I'm watching first season Janeway, and it's like, she's kind of flat. And the more you go, and the more we learn about her, the more I like her. And this is an episode that makes me just love every bit of Janeway, because she opens herself up. She reveals kind of what drives her.
This is true. It's a very character-defining kind of thing. Even though, yeah, it's sort of trying to do that, but it's in such a nice, subtle way. And we don't get a whole lot of that on Voyager, unfortunately. Kind of hearkening back to what you were saying earlier, Matt, about how you were so hungry for really any kind of character development. I think if we would have seen more of these casual conversations in other parts of the show, I didn't necessarily want to see these scenes in 1159 with the crew. I really wanted it to be just Janeway and Catherine and Shannon. But if we'd seen more of these conversations otherwise and more often, can you imagine what this show would be?
I mean, yeah, this should be the most connected crew, right?
Right.
Because they're not going to Starbase and bringing on new people and people leaving. If you work in engineering, you see the same engineering people every day.
Yeah, all day, every day.
7 years. And yet they should be just getting so close. Like, you look at what happened to Jules and Miles on DS9. There should be a Jules and Miles in every corridor on this ship.
Exactly. And we should know so much more about all of that, how that developed, learning about these people. This show had the potential to be the most richly developed character show because of how tight-knit they were going to become. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they dropped the ball so bad. And it really makes me sad because I love Voyager's characters. I want to know everything about them.
This is something that my girlfriend and I have been watching through Deep Space Nine because she has never seen the entire thing. So we're almost at the end of season six. And she loves Voyager because that was really the first show that she kind of got into Star Trek wise. And, you know, Voyager is anomaly of the week, you know, technobabble of the week. And that's what she's used to. And she really likes that. And so, like, an episode like this, she's kind of like, eh. You know, because it's breaking with the formula that they've kind of drilled into you if you've watched Voyager long enough, and this is really all you've seen. You know, for those of us who've seen something like Deep Space Nine, though, or, you know, even the original series where it's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, you know, we really want to understand and fall in love with characters and family. You know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, they are family. You know, Deep Space Nine, that crew is family. You know, Sisko has them over to eat all the time. You know, Miles and Julian are playing in the holodeck together. Kira is even hanging out with them. You know, Odo opens up by the sixth season and becomes a guy who will hang out at, you know, Vic's bar with you. I mean, so this is the kind of thing that you really wanted from Voyager, because like you said, Char, this should be the series where the characters are the closest ever, because they have nobody but themselves. They've got 150 people on a tiny ass ship in the middle of godforsaken Delta Quadrant, and this is the only episode where they have the time to sit down and have some coffee together and tell each other stories. That's pathetic.
Right.
Let me just also add about, we talk about Janeway. Now, Janeway is the one character who we do get development because she's the captain, so we see her through the series. But Matthew, you mentioned to me about Chakotay's scene. Now, I talk about wanting to cut all of the scenes on the ship out. I do like the scene where Janeway and Chakotay talk. I actually, throughout Voyager, I love the scenes where Chakotay and Janeway talk to each other privately, because that's the time when you actually get to see inside Chakotay. And I always think, what a great character Chakotay would have been if they had developed him that way throughout the show. I actually feel like Chakotay is a man who would be inspirational to the crew. He's very loyal. He has very reasonable views of situations, and he's thoughtful. But you rarely ever get that. And then here is, in this episode, there is that scene, and we get them in a few other places.
Yeah, when you get Chakotay, it's mysticism. It's let's find out, you know, his camping trip when he was a child. Let's see him, you know, talking about his spirit animal with Janeway. And it's interesting. I don't know. There's probably people who are more interested in those parts of Chakotay than I am. But if we'd seen stuff like Chakotay, like what really inspires him, like what really causes him to be the way he is, and what is the way he is, that's what we're constantly missing. We never see him, you know, we never, like we saw Picard at the academy and what sort of guy he was there. And we got to see the transition. We never get to see Chakotay at the academy. We never get to see the people he had a relationship with. It's just him, or it's him. And I don't, what was that episode? Yeah. It's just not a good episode. Little, part of the problem.
We get to hear little stories here and there, but it's just very little. Mm-hmm. It's just not, it's just so hit and miss, you know, it's just like every once in a while they throw out a few tidbits and then Matthew
but it's so not enough, especially when you're so hungry for it and they give you just a little nibble and you want a bite.
Yeah. And you want
more, in this episode, you know, Chakotay just comes off as being somebody very wise and level-headed and has a great view of, you know, the way that we view the past and what you can really get out of it, even though it is flawed. And man, what a great view of taking what we can from the past and trying our best to learn from it and then use that for our futures. And that's great character development. Again, that scene's like, what, 3 minutes long?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a beautifully written scene that deserved more to be seen more often in Voyager. And this is the show, I think, that showed me, man, would have been great if Voyager had every season done a flashback episode for one of its main characters, so that by the end of the series, you really had an idea of who all these characters were, because they do. They've got plenty of time just to sit around and tell each other stories, you know, and there's plenty of ways to do those stories without having to go into some kind of techno babble, you know, time travel cue type crap like that. Just let them sit around every once in a while and tell each other a story about their past that will be interesting for the future. Then you can use that to build off of.
Right. Some people would say that those kind of stories are boring and no one wants to see a bunch of people just sitting around. I highly disagree. Because, okay, as wonderful as the flashy space battles are and the alien of the week and all that, something like this is what I really, really adore in Voyager. If it's about the characters, I latch onto this. Some people don't like this episode because it's too slow and it's not really about Voyager's people, but it's so different, and that's why I like it. I wish this would have actually been more of what the show is actually about. I kind of like your idea, Matt, of having some sort of a backstory story for each of the main characters. I'm not so sure about a flashback, but if we could get to know the history of all of the characters in some fashion, creatively, how cool would that have been?
Well, Jeri Taylor wrote a book called, I think it's Pathways.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did.
And it was a great book because it did just that. You know, they were right. all stuck together, and they all, the only way that they had the time to pass, and I think it was they were caught in some kind of prison or something, and they're all telling each other a story about their past to pass the time because they have nothing else to do. And it was such a great book because you got a chance to kind of get to know, you know, from one of the creators' standpoints, who these characters were in the past.
Right.
And it was a great book because of that. And that kind of thing is what I would wish that they would have just done more of, because as we've all said, this episode is great, but it could have been awesome.
Right. I wish they would have integrated more of Pathways into the actual canon, sort of like what they did with Elements of Mosaic, which Jeri Taylor also wrote. That's the Catherine Janeway novel. I wish they would have had more of that in the actual series, but they chose not
and
to.
Maybe they would have if they had been syndicated like DS9 was. I think there was so much studio pressure to make a formulaic show here.
That was a big, big problem for Voyager, yes.
I think it was. So you talk about how good this episode is. This episode could have really been worse, because if you read some of the thoughts of Joe Minoski, who wrote the episode with Brandon Braga, he actually wanted to have more going back to the ship and more what he calls hard sci-fi elements in the story. He felt that the story didn't really work this way. And he says that they tried originally to do the story completely without Voyager, and it just wasn't working. And my thought on that is, and he said that they realized that they couldn't tell a story just on Earth without having Voyager to ground us in some way. And my response to him is that, no, you couldn't tell a story without Voyager to ground you.
Thank you.
That the story couldn't be told without that, because this story could have been told. I will say that maybe you need that little moment at the beginning, just so we know, okay, we're in Voyager, Janeway's remembering something from the past, but after that, you don't need to keep going back here.
And well, that's what Carbon Creek does, right? It cuts to T'Pol telling them the story from time to time.
Let me tell you a story.
But it's really mostly there on the planet, and that lets it really be able to get that whole story. Whereas I think your main problem with the episode is it keeps leaving it to do
it keeps leaving
something
the story
else.
To do something we don't really
need. I find
need.
That really distracting when they keep cutting back to Voyager, because I just want them to go back to Portage Creek. Let's hear that story. That's what I'm interested in. I find it interesting that they found that so hard to write. I mean, really? I realize that this is a unique Voyager episode, but that's why I love it.
Well,
what was the
other
problem,
thing Minoski
guys?
Says, and this is actually a quote from Minoski. He says, ultimately, to me, it was a lot of domestic scenes, which I am not interested in writing. Yeah, obviously.
Okay,
more
whatever.
Than anyone, I wish that we had had something of the hard science fiction element in it to drive the plot.
No.
But Rick Berman called to say he loved it. I just kind of shrugged. You just never know. So this is a case where, and people like to rag on Rick Berman. Rick Berman got it here, I think. And Minoski,
yay, Rick
who's
Berman.
Writing it, didn't get it.
Well, and I think, you know, Rick gets a lot of sometimes do and undo, you know, flack. But I think a lot of things he tried to do were good. And this is one of those where they took a risk. And fans had been, I think, given so much, just Techno Bagble and Anomaly of the Week, that they didn't respond to this as well. You know, if Voyager had more of a Deep Space Nine sense to it, where it was telling more of one kind of continuous story, you know, this might not have been so abnormal.
Maybe so.
This is completely abnormal. And like you said, Chris, they're having to deal with, they're not in syndication. They can't really do what they want to do. They have to be beholden to a studio. And the studio really at that point cared about ratings. And you know, how much bigger can we make Seven's boobs so more people will watch?
Oh, and they did. They focused heavily on that.
I guess I liked the Voyager scenes, not because they helped. I mean, okay, it was kind of two different stories being told. We're both learning about Shannon and the things she did. I also liked the idea of talking about history as being fuzzier than you think. And even in the 24th century, we don't have perfect view of the past. And I like that Janeway sort of cut down where they said, you know, she had this great idea, this grand idea about who her ancestor was. And they were like, well, we can't find her in the books at all. And Janeway has to come to terms with that. So it was character development for Janeway directly as well, which that's why I appreciated them cutting back to it. It was forcing Janeway to say, okay, maybe this person wasn't who she was, but the conversation with Chakotay. Okay, but I can still take something from it. If it had just been learning about Shannon, it would have added more to Janeway's past, but it wouldn't have really advanced her as a character in the same way that this episode was able to.
Yeah, you don't think they could have condensed that at all, though?
It's possible. I don't know. I don't know if we're getting close to final thoughts, but I just love every moment of this episode, and I wouldn't want to get rid of any of it. I love the scenes on the ship just because there's not some big anomaly happening, and we're just getting to relax and learn about things and see characters reacting to a situation that's not, we have to reverse the polarity. And maybe, okay, it is that I'm so desperate for it, but it really does work for me. I just sit back and smile for 45 minutes.
Well, I think the thing for me is that the scenes by themselves are fine for me. You know, I don't dislike the scenes. It's just that they keep interrupting the story that I'm trying to follow. And right. I feel like this wasn't the place to do that, which that may sound weird because I know they're telling stories about their ancestors. And so, yeah, maybe this is the place to do it. But I feel like they could have told more of their backstory along the way. Here, it just keeps yanking me out of the story. That's just how it was for me. But the scenes by themselves, I do agree. I would like to see more of the crew because we got that more on TNG. You know, we got where the crew would be relaxing with each other, chatting a bit more, talking about how their toes curl up and stuff like that. and we didn't see that as much. I won't say we never saw it on Voyager, but we didn't see it as much as I think we needed to.
Right.
I think that, too, this is one of those things where we'll never see this kind of thing again on Voyager. And that's, you know, we deal with that with Voyager all the time. You know, Janeway learns this about her ancestor, but it never has any effect in the future.
It doesn't have any impact on her.
And so, as much as this is wonderful to see this character development for her, you know, we don't see it ever happen again. But, you know, one of the things that I do pick up on is that when Paris talks about his family and what they were, you know, salt of the earth type people, that stays with me because that's who Tom is. He's salt of the earth.
That's true.
He's down to earth. He's funny. He's just a good old boy in at heart. You know, he's Trip Tucker before we knew about Trip Tucker. you know, who I see, you know, PDH to be. Apparently that runs in the family, you know. So all those things actually stick with me because those are very much their characters, you know. Some of what I learn about Janeway is great, but I don't really see a lot of impact since she was the one who was most impacted later on down the road.
And let's not forget that just a few couple of seasons before this, they went back to Los Angeles, 1996 in Future's End. Janeway says she has no idea what her ancestors were doing during this time period.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Liar. She must have just had a total brain fart while she was back in Los Angeles because clearly she did remember. Or we wouldn't have this episode.
Yeah, I think it's called lack of continuity in writing, Shark.
Yes.
Yeah, what's that?
Well, I think Memory Alpha tried to explain it by, well, she didn't know what they were doing in the 20th century because 1159 takes place in the 21st century.
No, so it doesn't. It Janeway takes place in 1999.
It's on the verge.
Well,
no.
Well, it takes place in 2000.
Yeah, it takes place in 2000.
So in 1996, she doesn't know what Shannon O'Donnell was up to. She could have been doing anything.
An aerospace engineer or was in school studying to be one. I don't know. Come on. It couldn't have been that hard to deduce. Didn't Aunt Martha know everything about this woman?
Yeah.
Surely Aunt Martha knew.
Yeah, that's definitely a case of you can't, like, those two moments don't exist, unfortunately, in the same continuity. Yeah. There's a way to square the circle.
Yeah. Aunt Martha was a genealogical genius.
Well, this is after Year of Hail, right? So maybe the timeline was
okay,
modified.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. Hey. Now there's a little loophole. Yeah. Nice work.
Oh, my goodness.
But then the change was reset also, so to a third possibility.
Well, yeah, there's that too. Never mind.
Oh, man.
Okay, right. Then.
Well, why don't we jump into our final thoughts here? We're about to hit an hour, so Matthew, anything else you want to share about this episode?
You know, I think that this episode, to me, shows what a Voyager could have done really well. It could have given us a lot of character moments like this. It could have really helped us know these characters in a way we had never known Star Trek characters before, by having them be the closest family we'd ever seen, and they just don't do that. Like Greg, though, I love every single moment of this episode. I watch it. This is my favorite Voyager episode, and I'm sure people will think that I'm crazy for thinking that, but this is the episode where I'm allowed to enjoy the characters for who they are. And for me, that's why I watch shows. I like characters and character moments. And so give me more of this, Voyager writers, and you will have a much happier Matt. This would be this kind of show may have surpassed Deep Space Nine if they had this kind of writing consistently throughout, you know, all seven seasons of Voyager, because these characters would have been really deep. And so, you know, honestly, for me, you know, I rate this 1159 out of 12.
Nice. Yeah, this is a favorite of mine as well. I don't understand why people don't like the episode that much, because I, too, am very hungry for characters. And if we would have had more episodes like this from the very beginning, or at least certainly earlier in the series and had more of them by this point, I think, yeah, Voyager would have been very different. And this is the kind of Voyager that I wanted. So I hold this one pretty close, and it is also a sentimental holiday favorite. It's kind of like a comforting warm cup of soup. It's just really good. It's comfort food. I love it. It's warm. And of course it's about Janeway, and she's my favorite captain, so of course I want to know more about what inspires her, even though it's not exactly as she imagined it. But again, that's something I also like. I love seeing the exaggeration come down from reality and Janeway dealing with that. And I don't know, as we've talked about these scenes and whether we like them or not with the crew coming back to Voyager, I'm still with you, Chris. I think they take away from what we're seeing in Indiana. I love the scenes themselves. If we would have seen them in a different episode, that would have been great. I wanted to see that. But as they're doing it in this episode, it just feels like it's a distraction. And I'm just thinking, hey, no, go back. So there's that. Still a really good episode. Just that one little flaw, I think. That and the Future's End thing with Janeway not remembering her ancestors. But that's Future's End's fault, not 1159, in my personal canon. So I'm going to give it 9 books.
Nice. And I basically said, I love every moment of this episode. I don't understand any criticism of the Voyager scenes, because I love them so much, even as part of this episode. I hate to be harping on, I wish Voyager had been more like this, because there are episodes like this. Like, we have 1159. Even Non Sequitur gives us an insight into who Kim is. I as I'm rewatching the show, I'm like, I don't have that much of a criticism with the show, except As Char, you and I were talking about off the air, it has hit. It's hit and miss. Like, you'll get a terrible episode, but it has enough great episodes that I see why people love Voyager so much. And this episode is part of it. Like, obviously they knew what they were doing and they had a great cast. And yeah, as you say, it's a great holiday episode. I love that we're doing it so close to Christmas, because it just, it really warmed my heart. It's the Star Trek It's a Wonderful Life. And that's great for me.
Yep. That's why I picked it. We had to do it before Christmas.
Yeah.
Good call.
Yeah. I know I've probably come off as disliking this episode, possibly. That's why I said up front that I like it. I really like this episode as well. I think it's one of the best episodes of Voyager. I love all the character development. I'm not quite as keen on the character development for the other crew members as maybe some of you guys are, just because it felt superficial to me. It's just too little. Like, they're just throwing it in there. So it doesn't quite work for me. And I do think that they kind of jumped the shark when the Doctor started telling the story about how he was descended from... He's a computer program, okay? but I love the story down in Portage Creek. I love the fact that we got kind of the real look at Shannon, not the look like we got from T'Pol of her grandmother or great-grandmother in Carbon Creek, although I like that episode as well. So, but this is a great tale about, yeah, being caught between the past and the future, and learning that sometimes you have to let go and you have to move forward. And it's scary, but, Char, like you said, you know, if you meet that person who, and Matthew, you said this as well, about helping you find yourself and helping you move forward in life, which I think is what happened between Shannon and Henry. It's a great story. So this is definitely a good episode, and I'm going to give this one 8 Tales of Ancestry.
All right.
I guess I forgot to give it a rating, so I should jump in and say I'll give it 9.5 grotesque shopping malls out of 10.
Excellent. All right. Well, we have, again, a full Trek FM crew here with us today, but go ahead anyway. And Matthew, tell people where they can find you around the internet.
Yeah, you can check me out at Twitter. I'm on the tweet face, whatever you want to call it. Got Matt Rushing 02. No, I did not try to run for any kind of elected office.
Yet.
So that's just a college reference. When I graduated, we're supposed to graduate anyway. I'm all over Trek FM, book reviewer, Literary Treks, as well as my main podcast with Chris, my illustrious co-host, in his always dulcet tones. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll be able to find my own blog. So,
excellent. And how about you, Char?
All right. Well, you know, of course, that you can find me all over the place on Trek FM. I might be editing, I might be writing, I might be making goofy Christmas avatars, putting our characters in Santa hats, what have you. You can find me on To the Journey.
To the Journey!
Okay, that's a little better, sort of. We'll have to work on this, guys. It's all about the timing. Anyway, you can find me there with Lori and Tristan. We talk about all things Voyager. And, of course, then you can find me on the Twitter webs at Oh the Profanity.
1159 really is one of the unexpected favorite episodes I have of Voyager. I come around to it every time expecting a different episode than I actually get. Maybe now that we've done a podcast on it, I will remember, no, this episode actually goes in a completely different direction than it looks like it's about to. I always remember, though, that I love it. I love the guest acting. I love the script. I especially love what Kate does. I love her hair for once. It looks like a normal person's hair. So, yeah, I'm so glad we were here talking about 1159 and having Matt and Char on. Voyager. I really do love Voyager. And sometimes I forget how much I love Voyager.
it explains a lot, Greg, after the weekend you've had, that you, like you said, you expect something different every time. You came in this time expecting to see Shannon O'Donnell help Bilbo Baggins close up his shop, yes, leave the Shire, and you didn't get that. And
I really didn't, yes. No, I like the scene where Shannon chases Henry down the street. I'm going on an adventure to Florida.
Even though I'm not 70 and it's not time for me to retire yet. Why else would you go to Florida these days?
Doesn't make any sense at all.
All right. But yeah, this is a great episode. And I do like Voyager. People think I don't like Voyager, I think.
It's Enterprise you don't like.
Star Trek. I love Enterprise. I actually like Enterprise better than Voyager, to be honest. But I like all of Star Trek. And I particularly do like this episode.
Yes.
So I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it. Well, let's tell everyone where they can find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on 1159, on anything we talked about in news, on Star Trek Into Darkness. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can send a message to the Ready Room that will come to Greg and me. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm. Google Plus, Hyperchannel /TrekFMG+, on ADN under username TrekFM, and on Twitter, of course, at username TrekFM. And Greg, what if people want to follow you?
Well, people can definitely listen to the Observation Lounge on TrekFM, where we do a general geeky podcast. If you didn't get enough Hobbit talk on this week's Ready Room, there's even more to be found on the Observation Lounge this week, so please check that out. And also, you know, if you want to see me, just walk into any random screening of The Hobbit in Seattle. It's a good chance I will be there seeing the film again. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN, where I'm probably, yes, talking about The Hobbit.
That's all you do. I woke up this morning. I had 73 messages from Greg on iMessage all about The Hobbit.
What can I do?
I get it, Greg. You saw The Hobbit and you liked it. All right. Let's move on. Let's be like Shannon and Henry. Let's move on into the future.
Yes.
To the next Hobbit movie, because apparently there's going to be three of them, even though there's only one book.
Yes. Yes. He's detonating story structure and everything it stands for, and just inserting as much as he can from everything else.
I just find it odd because I remember before they made Lord of the Rings, and the studio wanted to make two movies,
yes,
even though there are three books. And now there's one book, but they're making three movies. So I guess that's what happens when you make a boatload of money.
It's the way of the future, Chris. It's the way of the future.
It is. It's kind of the millennium gate of movie making.
Indeed,
I guess.
It is. So.
All right. Well, I just like to remind everyone, go check out Literary Treks with Matthew. You will be amazed at how much Matthew knows about the literary Star Trek universe, as he and I, but really it's mainly just Matthew, interviews some of the many amazing authors who are writing Star Trek novels these days. And of course, check out Char Onto the Journey, along with Tristan and Laurie, along with all the other shows from Colin, Mike, Max. We've got Sherv and Aaron. We've got Tom. We've got everybody. So many people on the network now. Just go to trek.fm, find all the shows there. And also, we would like to remind everyone to support our sponsor and the network. Go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK12 to save 10% off when you sign up for what, and I am serious here, not just because they're sponsoring us, but because I've used them for years, the best web hosting and CMS platform for blogs or huge websites, whatever you want to make. It's the best thing you'll find. So go check them out. squarespace.com/trek. All right, Greg, I'm going to go and turn on the TV. I heard that there is a great Sven Buttercup Hansen fighting match coming on right now, and I don't want to miss that.
All right, Chris, I think it's time to stick a bookmark in it, because the Ready Room is done.